36 years in the Indian Foreign Service, two postings in Moscow. Ambassador Rajiv Sikri, welcome to India, Russia and the World.
Thank you.
So the Iran war, it hasn't really ended after all, has it?
The Iranians have got this opportunity to break out of the jail in which they were for 47 years. And they have found that the Strait of Hormuz is like a nuclear weapon. They're not going to give that up. The Americans just can't stand the thought that they've lost this war, because none of the objectives for which they fought the war appear to have been achieved, whether it was regime change or the nuclear issue or
none of it.
Support to Hezbollah, Hamas, and so forth. None of it has been achieved.
But there was a ceasefire that was agreed upon. There was an MOU that was signed. What was all that then?
Yeah, I mean, ceasefire because the Americans and the Israelis tried to bomb Iran into submission, and they couldn't. They ran out of ammunition. Israel is not going to want this war to stop. The trouble is that this has become an existential issue for all parties. For Iran, it was a question of survival. For Israel, they consider Iran a principal rival in the region, which is preventing the total domination of the region by Israel. And for America, I mean, for a superpower not to succeed against a regional power like Iran is very humiliating. People are saying it's probably more humiliating than Vietnam. Certainly, the myth that American power can achieve anything, that has gone.
The strategic Chabahar port has been extremely important for India, given the fact that it leads way for India to get into markets in Central Asia. Then it cuts down trade time to, say, Afghanistan and Russia to trade with. Now, with the current situation only getting worse, do you think India needs to find an alternative to Chabahar?
Well, what is the alternative? Because Pakistan is not available. And whether it is Chabahar or Bandar Abbas, the international north-south transit corridor, which is being talked about, is the alternative for trade with Russia and the Central Asian republics. As far as Russia is concerned, I think we are rightly developing the Chennai-Vladivostok, that Pacific route. So, you know, that is an alternative. But certainly for Western Russia, for European Russia, there is no alternative to Iran. So it remains very, very important to us.
Russia sent former President Dmitry Medvedev for Khamenei's funeral. What message was Moscow trying to send there?
Well, Iran is very important to Russia because it's a neighbor. And any instability there and would affect Russia. Also, I don't think that Russia wants Iran to collapse. So I believe that they are giving considerable assistance in the security and technological sort of cyber and space-based assets and so forth. They've signed a security agreement a few months ago. Medvedev's presence signals that Russia will stand by Iran. It's a message to Iran and to America, Israel and the rest of the world.
India, Russia, China, Iraq, everyone sent their delegations to the funeral of Ayatollah Khamenei for a country that West wanted to isolate. That was quite a moment. What does that tell us?
Well, it just shows that the West is isolated on this question. And there's a lot of sympathy for Iran globally. I think Iran's stature has risen because they have stood up successfully to American bombing and bullying and so forth. And yet they've kept the door open for talks. Overall, I think Iran has emerged much stronger. I mean, very battered, but certainly its image and its potential is recognized. And it's no longer a factor that can be ignored.
Saudi Arabia also sent its deputy foreign minister for the funeral, and this despite years of hostility with Iran. What does this gesture tell us?
Well, Iran and Saudi Arabia had worked out an agreement a few years ago with Chinese mediation to have more normal relationship. While the Saudis did assist the Americans in their bases there in the early stages of the war, I think subsequently they said, no, we are not going to get involved. And they're reaching out to Iran because they recognize, like the others, that, look, Iran is a factor you cannot do without. We may have our differences about who's going to be the leader and Shia-Sunni conflict and so forth. But the reality is that Iran cannot be ignored. And, Israel has become actually the bigger threat to the region as seen by these countries.
You oversaw India's relationship with Iran, with Iraq, with the wider Arab world as secretary in the Indian Ministry of External Affairs. Looking back, has India's engagement with the region, you'd say, has fundamentally changed?
I think it's far more intensive now. You know, initially, I would say the relationship was, you know, we get oil from them, we send our Indians there, but we never looked at it as a strategic region. Mm-hmm. But it is really under Prime Minister Modi that this region has rightly got much greater attention and focus. Look at the number of times he's visited this region. When he visited UAE for the first time, it was the first visit by an Indian Prime Minister to UAE in 34 or 35 years. But now, you see, there's such frequent contact. It's where 10 million Indians live. So that's not something any government can ignore. And what has happened with this war brings out the perils of instability and what it would mean, even for the domestic politics in India. You know, states can get destabilized if everyone starts coming back or the remittances flow stops. We have rightly recognized now that this is a strategically important region in which we have to be very, very closely engaged.
To South Asia now, you've served in Kathmandu in your early 80s, and that's when monarchy was quite firm there. Would you say Nepal has evolved into a stable democracy today?
Oh, it hasn't. I mean, this is the problem that after the end of the monarchy, there's been more than a decade of instability. Governments moving in and out with unfailing regularity. The same group of actors.
And no government's been able to finish a term in Nepal.
Now, what happened last year when the coup took place, it was, I think, an externally inspired event. But fortunately, the army and the political class, then acting president, Sushila Karki, they played a very mature role and, you know, elections were held properly. Now, there's a new generation which has come into power. And there's a lot of hope and expectation from this new government. Balen Shah is an unknown quantity. I mean, he's rapper. He's been very cautious. He doesn't make many public statements. We have signaled through the warm welcome given to the president of the party, which is in power, when he came to India a few weeks ago and was received by the prime minister and others and so forth. We are signaling that, you know, we'd like to continue to do business with
them. Of course.
And both Nepal and India understand that the other country is very important for stability and so forth. And the essential thing which I think that India is looking for in Nepal is that, you know, we are prepared to give whatever it is in economic terms. And this applies to all our neighbors.
We always have, right? Always has,
So long as our security concerns are met. Now, this is where, you know, other players get in, whether it's the Chinese or the Americans or the Pakistanis or whatever it is. They try and muddy the waters because for them, this is a useful pressure point on India.
And how important is a stable Nepal for India?
Very important because there's an open border. And
there's China on the other side.
China on the other. They're very much into Nepal. You know, earlier there was an understanding that the Chinese would not be allowed into projects in the Tarai. But that has gone now. And, you know, we've had many governments in Nepal which have been very pro-Chinese. And the Chinese, unlike in the past, are playing a very active role in trying to influence Nepal's politics. They're also, that's one thing. The other is that they are very concerned about the activities of Tibetans in Nepal. So, you know, this is part of China's overall policy of keeping India constrained by, you know, developing its neighbors, ties with our neighbors in ways that undermine India's security, that keeps India a little anxious, and therefore India is unable to devote the kind of attention it can to other parts of the world because, you know, you've all got one eye on our neighborhood.
What's your assessment of Bangladesh's current leadership under Tariq Rehman? Is he going to be good for India?
Well, so far, Tariq Rehman hasn't done anything which has reversed some of the questionable and anti-Indian policies of the Muhammad Yunus regime. I mean, he made it a point to visit China and sign various agreements on the Teesta, on Mongla port and so forth. So far, I don't see much that has changed in Bangladesh's attitude. And I think India will have to be quite alert and watchful on what is happening in Bangladesh, because you have now a revival of the pre-1971 scenario where you had China, USA and Pakistan working in concert.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the Pakistani influence has grown. The Chinese influence was already there and is getting reinforced because now the Chinese have got projects which Sheikh Hasina had promised India. And the Americans are always trying to interfere in the whole August 24 coup, which ousted Sheikh Hasina, was done by the Americans.
Yeah, it was very clear.
Muhammad Yunus himself said it in New
in
York,
Washington,
meticulously planned and so forth.
Orchestrated.
Yeah,
by
so,
there's nothing left.
There's nothing left. We have to be prepared for it and not delude ourselves that, you know, things will be all right. I think we may be giving the gunmen there some time, but I don't think that we can wait too long before we have a clear perspective on Bangladesh.
I want to go back to Russia. You spent several years there.
Yeah.
And this was in the Soviet days.
In Soviet days, yes.
Would you say that the India-Russia relationship in Soviet days was different from today?
Yes, I think it was different because at that time there was a certain ideological component also in the Soviet approach to India, in communism, socialism, so, and so forth, helping us to build our industry, heavy industry, our institutions in the oil and gas sector, and so forth. And India was much weaker compared to the Soviet Union. Today, I think there's a more equal relationship because Russia is not what the Soviet Union was, and India has come a long way. I think also there's more pragmatism, no sentimentality. We see, you know, what is good for both of us. But one thing has remained constant, and that is the mutual confidence that both sides have, that the other side is not doing anything that is hurting our interests. That's very, very important. There's a lot of trust in Russia among political parties in India, among ordinary people in India. If you do a survey, say, which country do you trust the most? Russia would be at the top.
Oh, yeah, it's a very obvious sort of...
So that's a very, very sound foundation. And I think that Mr. Putin and various Indian leaders, including Mr. Modi, with whom he has an excellent relationship, have done a lot to keep up that thing. But that's not enough. I think what we need to do is to involve the new generation in both countries.
Yeah.
New areas of influence, so that they see the benefit in a closer relationship.
But you know, Ambassador Sikri, what I really want to understand from you, the India-Russia relationship, it really irks the West. Was it always like that, or is it something new which is happening now?
No, it wasn't always like that. I mean, we had normal relations, and the West may not have liked it, but they never interfered. As the relationship between Russia and the West has deteriorated, and they are using this as a means to pressurize Russia.
And India.
And India, exactly. Because this is another lever that they're using. You can't buy oil from Russia, you can't do Chabahar, you can't buy S-400, you know, stuff like that. I think we have done quite well in resisting that because, you know, while we gave in to the American pressure on Iran, I mean, we did not in the case of Russia because that's a far more consequential relationship in the larger scheme of things.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi and President Putin, they share a very comfortable rapport, very comfortable relationship. But do you think that the same comfort level exists in bureaucracy from both the sides?
I wouldn't know because I'm no longer part of the bureaucracy. But what I can tell you is that even in Soviet times, the bureaucracy did not understand each other too well. And it was only when you started actually dealing with the Soviet Union or Russia, you realize how important the relationship was. So there always has to be that direction and guidance and pressure from the top. I think the leaders are trying, but...
What's missing? Why is it not happening?
The economic relationship is not that strong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you were having $100 billion of trade with Russia, everyone would look at Russia more seriously.
By default, there would be more people-to-people.
Yeah, more people-to-people thing.
Yeah.
You don't have that. You don't have people going there. I mean, look at the number of people who go to America or UK mm-hmm. or whatever, students and... Indian origin people working in companies there and so forth, that people to people is missing. That's the weakness.
And do you think then for the next few decades, it needs a different approach?
I wouldn't say decades. I think things can change quickly. I mean, there's a push already. There's some proposals for manpower, for example, from India to Far East and so forth. And I think that Russia has also understood that its future, at least for the next few years, or maybe a decade or more, is not going to be with Europe. There's China, which is a relationship that has grown hugely. But I think as a Russian, they wouldn't say, we don't want to be too dependent on China. And certainly, they don't want to be seen as a junior partner to China. So who's the other big country? It's India.
In your book, Challenge and Strategy, you've argued that Indian foreign policy, it needs to create more space and more options. This is through flexibility and pragmatism. What does that mean in practice?
Firstly, we have to be very clear, have a clear vision of, you know, how do we see the future? And in that future, we have to see India as one of the top players in the world. Because for various reasons, whether it is a size, resources, population, self-perception, history, culture, you know, we are not going to be anybody's stooge. Now, how do you reach that? Nobody is going to give you a seat at the high table just because you asked for it. You have to fight for it. And power is always taken, never given. So now you have a situation. I think there's a window which is opening for India. America, we've just discussed Iran and the decline of American hegemony, the incipient moves towards de-dollarization, the lack of trust in America globally. The Europeans have made themselves geopolitically quite irrelevant. And there's China, which seemingly is on the rise, but it has its internal problems also. And if you remember in my book, Challenge and Strategy, by the way, I have a new one now, which I've just given you called Strategic Conundrums. Which is on the strategic aspects. I said, you know, China is like a huge pressure cooker. In India, if the pressure cooker is whistling, things are okay. The pressure is being released. So in India, the pressure is always being released. There's some agitation here, some problem there, something or the other. But that is pressure being released. and the democratic process releases the pressure. In China, everything is very, very calm.
Yeah.
But you don't know. And if a pressure cooker explodes, it explodes with a bang. Unfortunately, China's history is that of explosions.
BRICS. Many countries in the global south now see BRICS as a platform to make their voices heard. Is BRICS living up to those expectations?
I think many countries have joined BRICS and are wanting to join BRICS because they see it as an alternative to the West. But
There's snooty groupings that allow
the G7 and so forth. But what can be the practical outcome of the BRICS, is difficult to say because each country has its own interests and each of the countries has huge interests with the West. I think Minister Jaishankar put it well. He said that, we are not anti-West, but we are non-West. I don't think that India would like to convert it into an anti-West. Whether there can be more substance in the cooperation of the BRICS countries remains to be seen. A lot would depend on the bigger countries. And now you have, countries which are in conflict with another, the UAE and Iran and so forth. So that is why the BRICS of a recent meeting in Delhi, we couldn't come up with a statement on the war because different countries there.
But is a statement so important?
No, a statement is important in the sense that do we share a common perspective on the way forward in the world? I mean, we also have differences with China in BRICS. We have to see what are the common factors that can keep the BRICS countries together.
You spent so much time in diplomacy, 36 years. Have you ever seen the world so chaotic? And do you think it's going to get any better?
Well, we grew up in an era where there was a sense of optimism after the Second World War, the horrors of the war, and we deluded ourselves, the world as a whole, that this is going to be the state of affairs.
Like the world has learned something.
The UN was set up, the GATT, and then the WTO, and the principles of interstate behavior and so forth. All that has gone.
Yeah, those organizations don't stand for anything, do they?
No, they don't stand for anything. Look at the Security Council. Look at the WTO. They're irrelevant today. This is something I had mentioned in my book also, which is really amplified in the last couple of years, that the world is changing. And the period of the West's hegemony is getting over. The trouble is that the West has ruled the world for 500 years and they're not giving up and they can't believe that it's over or it's getting to...
Yeah, they're not ready to accept.
They're not ready to accept that. But it's a dog-eat-dog world. Power matters. And everyone is trying to leverage whatever advantages they have. The Americans have leveraged their control of the global financial and economic system, the dollar. The Chinese are leveraging their control of raw materials and critical minerals and manufacturing and so forth. So, even though India wants to reduce its imports and trade, it just can't because there's no one else who is producing that stuff.
What do you think is or will be India's leverage?
I think that two or three factors which are there. The first is geography. India is uniquely situated in the world. I've talked about how India is at the intersection of five arcs. There's the arc of prosperity, which is to the east, Southeast Asia and East Asia. You have the arc of instability to our west, right up to the Mediterranean. You have the arc of energy, which is the Persian Gulf, Caspian, Siberia, and so forth. You have the arc of communications, the Indian Ocean. And then you have the arc of uncertainty, China, Nepal, Central Asia. We don't know what's happening there. Now, don't forget that there's a reason why the Indian Ocean is called so, because India dominates it. And it means that we can reach out to all these regions. India was the reason why the British Empire could expand so much. It was the jewel in the crown. So that was the geography which was playing a role. So where are the openings for us? It is across the oceans. And that is why we are developing our maritime capabilities. We're with all the Indian Ocean countries, with the Southeast Asian countries. So the maritime dimension is the only dimension where we can expand. We just discussed Chabahar and, you know, the access to the continental thing. The second thing is our talent. Our people are very talented, and wherever they've gone, it's we've done very well. How do you harness the talent? For that, I think we need to do a lot more in terms of education and health and, you know, to improve so that you create that environment in India where people say, oh, we want to go and work in India. All those people, the H-1B wallahs who are in America, why can't we get them back? You know, this is something we have to work on.
Yeah, I mean, why should we be crying about another country not wanting to take Indians in?
I mean, we have global CEOs who are of Indian origin. So obviously they have the talent. Why can't we build up such systems in India? Which means that, you know, instead of infighting, you have to, you know, have a united perspective.
And may I add, cleaner air to...
Definitely, the cities is very important. One of the reasons why people are migrating is because you get better health, education and civic facilities.
Ambassador Rajiv Sikri, thank you so much for your time. It's been truly a pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me.